okay, I'm going to talk. I'm going to make this sort of a personal voyage, in a sense, how I got into this project, how it developed, how our ideas have developed of our collaboration, and also a lot of psychology of physics and how people look at physics, strange physics, and react to it, because that is really the way we have had to deal with this. The title, this is basically what I'm going to talk about. The Pioneer Anomaly, I'll explain what it is. The data which gives this anomaly. What we have come to decide it means, what we know, what we don't know, because that's always very important if you're dealing with data. And a possible set of future tests of it. We had an original collaboration. There were six of us. Three from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, John Anderson, Eunice Lau, Slava Turishev, and two essentially from the Aerospace Corporation. But actually, they originally were at JPL, and there is an important tie-in, as you soon shall see. We had an introduction, which I'll come to, which was the first time we announced this, which was in 1994. Our discovery paper was in PhysRev Letters in 1998, and our monster 50-page physical review with everything you never wanted to know about spacecraft was in 2002. Okay, the data. This is, notice the name, Pioneer F. The Pioneers were the first craft. The Pioneer series was a set of discovery missions of NASA in the 1960s. Pioneer 10 was the first craft to go into deep space. By that I mean past Mars. The designation of these craft was always given by a letter, because if it exploded on the launch pad, they didn't want to have a missing number. So it was Pioneer F up until it got into orbit, or really into the trajectory, actually, and then it became Pioneer 10. This is when it's still Pioneer F, and if you look at the size of the scale of things, there's a door. It's sort of quaint. You know, these sort of gauges, type of thing you expect from an old science fiction movie. It was built on the technology of the 1960s. And it was an unbelievable craft. It worked. It has worked. I used to say it worked. Now I'm going to say it has worked for over 30 years. And I'll tell you why in a second, why I've changed it to it has worked. There's the launch of Pioneer 10 on March 2nd, 1972. This is a photograph taken the day after launch at JPL. Three of the members of our discovery team are in that photograph. There's Tony Liu, Phil Lang, John Anderson. Notice for the students the stack of cards which says last card in the deck. The reams of computer output paper. The Tektronix scopes. Okay? This was in the days when your data arrived in very slow packets. Okay? Now, these guys were worried at this time because it was actually going in the wrong direction, slightly, enough to miss Jupiter. And you know, since I'm getting into a good mood, it turns out that this was going to be the first test of the JPL orbital data program, orbital determination program, into deep space. And they were developing it at that point. And it really wasn't quite working right. Independent, Tony and Phil were developing a separate code called POIUS. And because of the politics of the time, the guy who was in command of this section ordered them not to use POIUS. They had to use the sanctioned ODP program. And they were going to lose the damn craft. So what they did was to use Poeas to get the right orbit, take the parameters, put them into ODP, then rerun things, and hey, they got the right answer. As you can see, scientists have been dealing with bureaucrats for a long time. So anyway, they did get it pointed in the right direction. And here is a picture of the large antenna of the Deep Space Network station outside of Madrid. Okay, you send your craft off. How do you get the signals? Well, if they're far away, you need a big antenna with a lot of power radiating out. And you're going to have a weak signal coming back. You know, sort of like a few watts at the spacecraft, and you've got to detect it coming back. You need an antenna also. But in the meantime, if it's too far away, the Earth is turned. The round-trip travel time now is over 24 hours to the Pioneers. And when it was 16 hours, what do? Well, you have three stations, one quarter of the Earth around. One outside of Madrid, that's the one in that photograph. One outside of Canberra, Australia. One in the California desert. Then you've got to have your clock synchronized so that you know what data is coming out compared to what data is coming back. Okay, what happened was that Pioneer 10 was launched first. It reached Jupiter and was the first craft ever to reach Jupiter. A personal story again. Those of you who are younger than me, which is most people in this room, are very used to the NASA photographs of Saturn and Jupiter with a red dot, with a red storm in the center, and all the fine grains of the rings of Saturn. If you look in an old astronomy textbook before 1974, you got these fuzzy things, not quite clear. Pioneer was the first craft to get this type of photographs. And I remember watching on television as these pictures came down. They actually were not a photograph. They were a set of strips which were brought together. And it was mind-boggling. You know, this was truly an amazing transition in the way we viewed the solar system. Okay, and then it went out in this direction, away from the solar system. Since they had been successful with Pioneer 10, they had money, could build two in those days in case one failed. They decided to be tricky and chose an orbit so that Pioneer 10 went by Jupiter, came back inside the solar system, and hit Saturn. And that was successful also. This, if you see a later version of this talk, I'll have this out. I mean, I'll take the photograph out. I just jumped this in last night. Okay, here are the large orbits of the crafts, and the Sun is going in the galaxy while around us there are stars sort of going this way and that way, including interstellar dust. And the local interstellar crowd is causing a bulge in the solar heliosphere. I should actually have Phil give this part of the talk. And so, therefore, three of these craft, the Voyagers included, are heading towards the heliopause. And the Voyagers are still alive and may reach this intersection of the Earth's magnetic influence and the interstellar medium. It has not done that yet. We hope it will. Okay, now, things were fine. They reached Jupiter. They reached Saturn. Everybody was happy. But the instruments were still working. You know, the dust detectors, which could get information on the amount of dust and gas in interstellar space. Infrared could also help with the gas and dust. And they had been magnificently successful, so they applied for a mission extension. They were only hoping to last 3 years, and they already were out there for 5, 6, 7 years. And they got it. So, you know, you've done your precise navigation. Everything is wonderful, but you know, the radio science team, this data is coming in. So every so often they did a check to make sure that their orbit determination was correct. And starting about, 1975 or so, 76, it took a point, and this is units of 10 to minus 13 centimeters per second squared. This is a small unit in terms of normal navigation, and you'll see that, you know, they're going in the right direction. You know, the error basically overlaps zero. Then there was this huge data point around 10 AU. And then periodically they did yearly data samples, averages. And there began to be this consistent offset of what amounts to an acceleration of 8 angstroms per second squared. Not much, but over many years that adds up. Now, let me stop right now and emphasize something. This is a Doppler measurement. Okay? You send out a signal. Very precise signal. Got your clock set. Send it out. Reaches the craft. It's transponded back. Comes back home. And you literally, at the station, count the cycles. 1, 2, 3. 2,111,562. 0, 1, 2. Okay, that's what they do. And then they got this signal back of the frequency there, which is different than the one they sent out, even with the transponding. And they say, well, you know, we got gravity in there, so that shifts things. We've got the gravity of Jupiter. That shifts things a little bit. We got the velocity. That shifts it. We got the fact that the craft is being pushed by the radiation pressure of the sun. You got to take care of that. We got the fact that the space antenna is hanging, so it sags. Take care of that. Whoops, there's a big solar tide, so the antenna of the space network is bulging up. Take care of that. Troposphere is different. There's a storm coming from the sun. All these things they put in. I mean, that's very, very accurate. But in the end, they should, with this craft, and I'll tell you why in a little bit, be able to get this down to the error of that first error bar. And they continually got something like that. So these guys, especially John Anderson, who is the one who's been looking at this for the longest time, just sort of, you know, sat on it. And talk to their friends, what do you think? Well, you know, can't say much of anything. But then I was going to give a talk in 1974 at the Low Energy Anti-Proton Physics Conference. And it was they wanted me to talk on gravity and antimatter, which is a dear love of mine. And I decided, well, let's make it a broader talk. Let's make it, how well do we know gravity or not know gravity in the universe? And by no, I mean, can you predict something to 60 significant figures like you do in QED? And if that's what you mean by no, we don't know nothing about gravity over most of the universe. We know it exists, but we can't quantify it. That is to say, to make it work, we've got to put in dark matter, which I postulate to you is creationism. Okay? So I said, well, how far in are we to the point when we really can predict? And I quickly convinced myself, not outside the solar system. So I said, well, it must be inside the solar system. So I said, gee, that must be the Voyagers, which were the most modern deep space craft. So I phoned up Don Hellings at JPL, and he said, well, you should talk to John Anderson about this. So I emailed John and asked him. He says, and he explained to me, I need a lot of explaining in those days, still do, but I need them more then, that you don't want to look at the Voyagers, you want to look at the Pioneers. And then he sent me an email, which all of a sudden said this: by the way, the biggest systematic in our acceleration residuals is a bias of 8 times 10 to the minus 13 kilometers per second squared directed towards the sun. Now, this is 8 angstroms per second squared. I literally almost fell off my chair when I read that. Even though that's small, I knew in that game that was huge. So I basically said, John, we've got to look at this. I didn't say that, but I said, someone's got to look at this, and it's his data, and hoping, why didn't he invite me in? And he did. And that's how we got started. Okay. So the external reactions. It must be a glitch that will go away with time. This code works. That's the first reaction. We have this code which now really works, and we know it takes us to anywhere we want to go. You see, you got to realize, a physicist wants to know what gets you there. An engineer just wants to get there. It's a different way of thinking. It's a proper way of thinking, but it's a different way of thinking. Okay? They knew they got to everywhere they wanted to get, and the code works. And if you got something wrong, it must be a glitch. Okay? It did not go away. But then, and who cares if it's small and things work well enough? And then we started jumping up and down strongly. It's in the data. This really is in the data. So finally we got to the point where people became convinced it was in the data. Well, then it must be the code after all. Don't bother us unless you show it. It is not in the code. You know, And that's where, remember Tony and Phil, who had been developing their own code? They went to the Aerospace Corporation, and they completed developing this code, which is called CHASM. It is line by line independent of ODP. So, they joined the collaboration, and they put it through their code. And by God, it was there. You know? So it's not the code. And by the interesting sociology, let me answer that later, a couple of years later. There was a third code which was done to look at it. And this code found it too, and this was psychologically important because that was an East Coast code. The other two were West Coast codes, and you know, I'm serious. Okay? So, therefore, it is now agreed it is in the data. Okay, there is this anomalous Doppler shift. Oh, that's the wrong way. Sorry about that. Oh, by the way, this is the signal in the CHASM code. Okay, just linear, just grows with time. Basically, the count cycle goes off with time. And if you want to have some more fun, I'll tell you about these outliers, what they mean. But you can see it's there. And this is the ODP version of the results later. You'll notice there seems to be an annual term in there. Okay? We have shown it is in the data. Has nothing to do with the anomaly. We think it's the fact that there's something wrong with the affirmities with regards to the pioneers, their orientation in the plane of the ecliptic. We think that's what's doing it. We hope to look at that later. I'll come to that at the end of this talk. But that has nothing to do with the basic anomaly itself. Okay, so we announced this in 1998. First thing that happened, as I will come to next, got to be a systematic. We know it's systematic. Okay, and we started answering things one by one, and we came to the conclusion we got to go over this from beginning to end. And this is where, as I've said to my friends, I got to know more about spacecraft than I ever wanted to think about in my life. And we eventually compiled an error budget, of which these here are the biggest ones. Those are the ones you ultimately have to worry about. Okay. First is the radio beam. That actually is nice. It makes it bigger. This is an acceleration towards the sun that is seen. The radio beam is actually pushing it away. So whatever effect we see is actually augmented by the fact there's a radio beam, 8 watts. The biggest questions for most people are either the RGG heat reflection, I'll come to RGGs in the next slide, basically heat, you got to worry about heat, and the thermal cooling of the spacecraft and gas leaks. We came to the conclusion that this is the error budget. And that is the final number. 8.74 plus or minus 1.33 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. That is the size of the anomaly. It's about a 15% effect, you know, error bar. So it is not a 3 sigma effect. I mean, this is, it's really in the data. Okay. The RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators. first craft to go to deep space. How do you power a spacecraft? You put out thermal panels, and from these thermal panels, with solar cells, make electricity. Great, as long as you're close in. By the time you get out to Jupiter, the size of these solar panels is too big. They occupy a football field. So, you got to have another way to do it. What was decided was to use plutonium, 238. Now, 238 is not the 239 that goes boom in the night. It is a different isotope which has a half-life of 87.74 years, basically alpha decay. It's hot. If you try to pick up a hunk of that junk, which you don't want to do, it burns you. It's very hot. What they did, and this was actually, RTGs were used a lot by the Russians also, especially to do things like light up their lighthouses in the Arctic during the winter. You build a central container in which they deposited 18, being from Canada, you'll like this, they called them pucks, little discs of a plutonium molybdenum cermet, an alloy, which has some ceramic to hold it together. 18 of them piled up in each one. Four of these things for the pioneers, two on each end over here. And this makes a lot of heat. In particular, there were 2,500 watts of heat at launch. And you use thermistors, thermocouples, to convert that into electricity. 165 watts of electrical power at launch. And that powers the spacecraft. So, the idea is, look, you got 2,500 watts, actually close to 2,000 when we're talking about, and you only need 63 watts to cause this effect. Must be reflection. Must be heat. Got to be heat. How is it heat? Well, look at the configuration. Obviously, the heat comes here. Here's the back of the antenna. Reflects off backwards. That's it. End of story. Go away. Don't bother us. Well, let's do a little calculation. How much of 4 pi does the antenna actually occupy from the viewpoint of the RTGs? When you actually calculate it, it's between 1.5 and 1.7%, 1.8%. That's two calculations we did and a third that a guy who didn't believe us did. That immediately reduces the number down to 40 watts. Then it's not a spherical ball. It is made so that most of the radiation comes out these fins, which you notice are much larger in the final version than was what was thought about. This was to have more radiation out the fins, have them go out on the side like this, not go towards the antenna, be radiated symmetrically in the transverse direction to the spin, and so therefore it goes out to space. We don't care about that. So therefore, in the end, this can only occupy for a few percent of the effect. The next idea was that there was heat radiating from the bus itself. The heat in the bus decays even faster than the RTGs. That's not going to do it. Now, in all honesty, if God came down to me and said, Michael, you're going to bet your soul on this question. Is it a systematic or not? Hey, God, it's a systematic. I know it, you know it, all that kind of junk. Okay? If, however, he gives me $100 to take to the casino, then I'm willing to think about new physics. I mean, that's my psychology. My psychology is also driven by the fact that I don't want to make a mistake. The biggest mistake I or we could make is to say, we got something funny here, we discovered something great, and then you go off and chase the something great. Ah, look at the data. We have an anomaly. Look at it in the sense that it's got to be a systematic and you haven't found it yet. When you finally beat it into the ground and when it's not a systematic, that'll come out. But do it right. So that's the way we go at it. Okay. Now, what do we really know from our big study? We know for Pioneer 10 from about 40 to 70 AU, there is a constant acceleration. By the way, see this small error here? That's just the statistical error. That is not the, you know, systematic error. I mean, that's another reason why we say it's in the data. It's just clear as hell. For Pioneer 11, between 22 and 31, it's also a constant. And the analysis combined is giving us this number. Now, a question to understand why we chose this data. Close in to the sun, the craft has a huge effect of solar radiation pressure, much bigger than the size of this effect. Now, that falls off as one of our R-squared, so you think you wouldn't have to worry about it. Not quite, because if that's the sun, the spacecraft points in this direction, depending upon where the Earth is. And that means it has a different aspect ratio. So therefore, different surfaces are reflecting the solar radiation. So therefore, that number will change with time, even though generally it falls off as one of our squared, and you could confuse it. So we wanted the clean data way out from the sun where we didn't have to worry about that. I mean, this data is very clean. So, further, it is seen only on small hyperbolic craft and hyperbolic orbits. It is not seen, this effect is not seen gravitationally, on the orbits of the planets. If you want to say this is gravity, it's funny, because you don't see it, because you would see this in the difference of the Earth and Mars distance. And we have laser ranging now. So it disagrees with that. So, if it's gravity, it's not normal gravity. And it could be something different. Because, remember, this is a Doppler shift. We interpret it as an acceleration. It could be something about an acceleration of time. That always gets the alpha dot people to stand up. But it could be that. We're just saying that's in the data. Okay, so then if you want to believe us and say it's not systematics on board, then maybe it's a manifestation of normal physics, a new manifestation of it. What about dust density and drag? What if I say, well, these things are going radially outward, and there's interplanetary dust, and so the ship is just dragging against it and slowing it down? So, went through that exercise. There are good measurements now about the amount of interstellar dust and in the solar system and interplanetary dust in the solar system. And this is the sort of figures that people come up with. And this is the size of the acceleration you would need to cause the Pioneer anomaly. Turned around, this means that we have an experimental limit on the amount of interstellar dust and gas in the solar system. It's orders of magnitude than what we know it is, but it's an experimental bound. So the bottom line on dust drag is that if it is that, it's not normal matter. It could only be dark matter. Dark matter people set up. Next idea is, well, it must be gravity due to the Kuiper belt. A lot of stuff out there. And if I put it right, I'll be able to mimic this constant acceleration. And why do you think that? Well, it's a well-known theorem that if I have a spherical density of 1 over r that goes into 0, so it's an infinite amount of mass, then I get a constant acceleration. This is an exercise in geophysics, actually. Geophysicists like to play with games like that. So therefore, maybe I can have a shell that does that, and that will explain the gravity. Okay, we'll do that exercise too. Actually, if you think about it, if you have a disk, therefore you don't have the Birkhoff's theorem or Gauss's law that it's zero force inside and it's like a point outside. You get a change. And so actually, the depending upon your model, gravity, although you can maybe get something like that within a certain region, there'll be a huge spike here and a huge anti-spike there. Now, that's like saying when you just get just inside the ring is going to be pulling you backwards. And so you can't model that. So what do we only suspect or do not know? We have no real idea how far out the anomaly goes. We just know that it continues out roughly as a constant from about 10 AU. But before Saturn encounter at 10 AU and the transition to hyperbolic orbit, Pioneer 11 did not show the anomaly. Remember that early data? And Pioneer 10 shows an effect starting only about 10 AU. That was the early data which we sort of roughly looked at. Remember that? Does that mean there's a turn-on of the anomaly at 10 AU? At Saturn, Pioneer 11 reached escape velocity. Anomaly had a big error. Is it a drag turning on or the escape velocity? Pioneer 10 escaped at Jupiter. We just are suspicious of that. We don't know. So let's consider what could be a future test. The first thing we can do, and this is what we're just about to start, is to go back to the early data. Remember I told you we used the later data because we had to prove the effect was there. And that later data would cleanly show the effect was there. So now we want to see if it turned on. Does it continue? Does it have a fall off, which the people who say it's systematics demand it must be? Well, as usual, technology changes. This old data stored on obsolete 7 and 9 track tapes. It was taken down from the Deep Space Network, the raw data, and then it was sent through the, what they call the stripper, which stripped out the orbital data, the radiometric orbital data from it, to put it into the code. This was a specific piece of C software designed for a specific VAX, which was about to be decommissioned. So then goes the story of, like, about 2 years, we were putting up houses of cards, getting 5,000 here, 10,000, so we can actually get the money to, hey, this is a government lab, you need a cost code. Okay? I mean, so we were trying to get on the order of, $25,000 just to save this data. And a couple of times we had the house of cards built up, and then the end of the fiscal year comes and some guy needs his money, takes it back. Finally, this year, we did it, the real push being done by Slava. So that most of that data is now retrieved in a modern format. By most of, I mean all the data starting from 1978, which includes the Saturn flyby. And that's very important to us. Okay? Our hope to do a possibly better three-dimensional orbital determination. Remember, since all we have is Doppler, that Doppler is best in this direction. You determine the transverse directions by integrating out the orbit. You know, it's over there, you know that. Started here, you know that. You have the Doppler of how it changed with time. And so therefore you put it in your columns. Here, got there, not quite. Come back here, start. That sort of iteration thing. Till the orbit converges. The end result is that in general, the unknowns, the errors in the orthogonal directions are about an order of magnitude more imprecise than they are in the radial direction. But closer in, those things will be able to be seen possibly better. If it's towards the sun, that probably means it's gravity. If it's towards the Earth, the direction of this acceleration, it's maybe time. Along the velocity, then it's a drag or inertia change. If it's on the spin axis, it's internal systematics. Okay? Because when we say it is towards the direction of the sun, that's within the width of the antenna. And way out there, that's the whole orbit of the Earth. So this early data will help us better determine that. And that's just a view of what the different signals would be. Okay, I said that we had this type of orbit. This shows you the flyby characteristics of the two planets and also the flyby of Saturn. So that data we now have, we're going to start analyzing them very soon. How long will it take? Well, the second time it takes about a week. The first time, I would guess a year. Everything goes right. That means 2 years. So we should be able to have the whole path from 1978 out to 2002. The last data wasn't that good, but it was there. So that's a long period of time, 34 years. And we should be able to find out if there is indeed 24 years. Sorry about that. We should be able to find out if indeed there is a fall off with time. That I hope very much we can do. We hopefully also will be able to see, is there or is there not an onset as it passed by Saturn? And or is this because it got off a certain distance, or is it because it went to hyperbolic orbit? We don't know. We'll find out. We hope. So with luck, that'll give us a first new input into trying to eliminate some of the possibilities for this anomaly. The next thing is possibilities for an add-on experiment. There is a window of opportunity. It's called the New Horizons mission of Pluto. Turns out that in January, the New Horizons mission to Pluto will be launched, all things being equal. That's a good laugh. Here it is on the test pad. This is the artist's concept of what it's going to look like. Why is this interesting to us? Well, this is absolutely positively not the way we would design a spacecraft to test for our anomaly. But it's a spacecraft. And it's going out there. Notice the RTGs are off to the side. I'll tell you how we would do it in the next few slides. But we were looking at this mission and we looked at what they could do, what they might do, and we said, aha, why is that? Okay. Way back towards the beginning. Remember I said these were the most precisely tracked spacecraft ever to go in deep space. And why is that? They are spin stabilized. Okay? Two ways to keep you got to keep the antenna pointing towards the Earth or else you're not going to get your data. How do you do it? Way number one, have a little gas thrusters. You got this antenna and it starts to go. You go back over here. But then it goes too far. You go. So, things like the Voyagers have this sort of stabilization. They got it very precisely down. They can do it very well. But the errors in modeling, you have to model that in your navigation. And the errors in modeling the navigation makes the error in the total navigation bigger than our anomaly. I've even checked recently with the Ulysses people, with the Voyager people, and they say, yeah, it's about an order of magnitude greater, the error bar. So you can pull this effect out. The other way to do it is to spin stabilize it. Why is that? Why is that good? It's a gyroscope. Okay, you put a big gyroscope out there. It doesn't move. It just stays there like that. The only thing that moves is the Earth. So once every 6 months you go, and then once every 6 months maneuvers, that they can model well enough. So that's why it was so precisely tracked. And another why they put it in a spin stabilization mode. Again, you go back to this. This is a series of lucky breaks. That was because, remember these RTGs, radioactive junk, horror, all that kind of stuff? You'd never had spacecraft going out with stuff like that. They didn't know if the if the transistors, you know, the transistors in those days, you wire them one by one, is this stuff going to work? Is it going to be zapped by the alpha particles from the RTGs? Don't know. Don't think so. It could be. Put them at the end of booms, far away. Put them at the end of booms, well, then you got to rotate it. Wonderful for us. Well, why didn't other people do that? Well, hey, one of the most important fundraising things for NASA is pictures on television. Okay? Three-axis stabilized takes wonderful pictures. Just beautiful pictures. That's the way you go. But what we found out about this thing is the following. They intend to launch it, maybe take it by Jupiter for an assist, and then cruise for a long, long time until it gets to Pluto. At about 4 AU a year, it's going to take 10 years to get there. And they can either do spin three-axis stabilized, or they can, because of the design of it, they could do spin stabilization. Furthermore, they were just going to be dormant during that cruise. You know, go by Jupiter, what for them, what physics to do? Every so often they're going to go, you know, phone home, thank you, okay? And just to make sure things are working. And after 10 years, turn everything on and fly by Pluto. But they could be on beacon mode. So that doesn't cost anything. The RTG power, you just turn the thing on, leave it on. So what we want them to do is, hey guys, you don't care what's going on. Why not spin stabilize it? Why not operate beacon mode? Then you could, in principle, just do a radio science experiment. There are a couple of guys in their team who thought about it. We're going to make a presentation to them next month at their science meeting to propose that they do this. Everything is not that beautiful, of course. There's one caveat. The caveat is you got to find the money to turn on the deep space network to point in that direction. You know, as we all know, to do a particle physics experiment at Fermilab is not that hard. You just plug in and you keep your magnets running and so forth. Ah, but to run the accelerator, there is the problem. The problem here is we have to get funding from NASA to have deep space network coverage. If that is obtained, then this could be done. And that would be a rough test, experimental test, which could occur in about 3 years. You could start getting good data. Actually, if they went by Jupiter, even sooner. Okay, finally, there's the dedicated mission. That's our, you know, God is kind, He loves us, He's going to give us all the money we want. We want a craft that's spin stabilized, precise Doppler, and range navigation, RTGs that ends along booms, thermal design with low asymmetry, all the stuff I've talked about. There are three ways you might do this. A four-asymmetric deep space mission, that was what we first thought of. Formation mission, the Europeans the Germans, have thought about that, and the French have talked about an accelerometer. Okay, this is an idea which we have come up with. This was basically to show how you would do it so it could work. You know, that sort of pioneer-like, except look, it's symmetric. Anything that reflects off here goes symmetrically fore aft. All of the heat comes out the louvers. That craft, a priori, would give you exactly what you want. Broadcast in both directions, so radiation force cancels. Positions of RTGs and louvers, symmetric. That would mean any heat would be symmetric. You would just get rid of that completely. If you had any effect, which was around and you said it was still a systematic, turn the craft by 180 degrees, you can do that. That would cancel out. No problem. This works the way you want it to do. Now, who's going to pay you $250 million to build this? Okay? With off-the-shelf technology, we would do it. And even with new technology, we could do even more. Okay? This is the same thing I said about the louvers. I'm getting a little behind, so I'm rushing. As I said, it would kill the systematics. And so this is our proposed mission concept. Am I going backwards? Yes, I am. That's what the problem was. Sorry about that. Ta-da. Okay. So, we were doing all this stuff, and then it turns out that perseverance pays off. Turns out there were a group of Europeans who had noticed how stubborn we were. We just kept beating the drum, and every time somebody took a swipe at us, we swung back and answered the critics one by one by one. And so they got interested in it. And all of a sudden, we were invited to a conference in Bremen to sort of be keynote speakers at the University of Bremen on the first conference on the Pioneer Anomaly. Huh? You know? And turns out that the European Space Agency people were interested in performing a test. However, now we're starting to talk to practical guys. Remember I said, who's going to give you $250 million? Well, as you know, the important thing is you do the right thing. Not that you have the right reasons. Where do you get money for? New technology. That brings in money. Okay? So, you get a new technology mission that, oh, by the way, can do a little science. Gotcha, I'm with you, okay? What's the new technology? Formation flying. Look at this craft. We only have one antenna, but it's built symmetrically. This, for the time being, is to make them think that this is sexy. What we have here are the RTGs close with what they call Winston cones. Those are basically parabolic reflectors, which will reflect the heat back out into space symmetrically. I would actually use the Winston cones, put them on, boom. But that's to come. What would be new is that we would send off from this side a laser cube, a corner cube covered sphere, which we would track with a laser, a milliwatt laser, from the craft itself. So therefore, we would get, in principle, a good measurement to the mother craft, an even better measurement to the laser. Now, money for formation flying, because you're worried about LISA, LISA Pathfinder in the future, there maybe you can get money. So that is our, foot in the door sort of thing. We have put forward this proposal to ESA under its fundamental physics program. We've gone through two hoops. We haven't been thrown out the door yet. And we are in full, how these things, committees meet and they're quiet and they're silent and you listen to the noises the mice make in the corner. And we are under the impression, let me put it that way, we're under the impression that at the meeting of the ESA science ministers in December, it will be decided to ask for calls for missions which will do fundamental tests of gravity, i.e. we're included. We are able to now make a serious proposal to ESA after our two preliminary proposals. Now, of course, there's a lot of politics. This laser cube, that's a German idea. Now, the French want to have an accelerometer on board. No, more to the point, they want an accelerometer, not a laser. And the Germans want a laser, not an accelerometer. So we have to convince everybody that, hey, man, the French give us 50 million euros, they can have their accelerometer. And the Germans give us their 50 million euros, they can, whatever you want. I mean, that's my attitude, okay? So, that is our long-term hope and goal. And we'll know more about that in about 6 months. Let me skip that because that's basically summarized what I've been saying. Except that 7-year lifetime, nominal, if you had a velocity of 8 AU a year. Normal craft go about 2 to 3 AU a year. We've got to get there fast. We want to get out to deep space where the anomaly was measured. Furthermore, we want to get there while I'm still alive. So therefore, we want to get there fast. the orbit. We want to be a solar system escape trajectory in the plane of the ecliptic. And you need a big launcher to get there fast. Ariane 5, Proton, or any heavy vehicle like the Delta IV. If it's European, it most likely will be an expensive Ariane 5. However, you might consider the more inexpensive and actually more reliable so far Proton rocket of the Russians. I must say, and I like to say this, I love that thing. This is Russian engineering at its best. Is simple. Is sledgehammer. Is works. It's basically a can of fuel with a match to stick out the end. I mean, in these terms. And by God, it works. It works very, very well. As I said, the test can be either a standalone mission or a probe of a large mission that is jettisoned with final propulsion is over. Such a mission will unambiguously determine the validity of the Pioneer anomaly. Suppose it turns out to be a systematic, which I keep telling myself, I say to everybody, most likely it is. We make it a point in all our papers to say it is most likely a systematic. If it is that, then we have done a good thing in that we have aided spacecraft design and navigation. And we've already seen effects of that. That is to say, we interact with the LISA, the laser interferometry people, the space mission. And we've started pointing out to them things they got to worry about in their mission. People are now conscious of this, of non-modeled forces of this type. So we have done a service already to the space science community, which at the minimum we will have done if this is a systematic. So it would be very important, independent of if the anomaly is new physics. But if the anomaly exists, but I mean it is new physics, then by God, it is fun. And we, I am now, I'll say I, but we really, are now finding ourselves trying to hold down by union card, I'm a particle theorist, okay? And now I'm trying to hold down my colleagues who are coming up with better and better ideas as to what is the cause of this. And I listen to all of them, I critique all of them, I endorse none of them. Because, as I said, we can't make mistakes. There are ideas such as MOND, which has an effect of this type, modified Newtonian dynamics. John Moffat, whom you know, has some modification ideas of gravity. If you look on the web, there are more and more, more ideas coming out about this. We have passed a threshold in the sense that people now, we don't go away, okay? And they're paying attention to us, which, of course, is very flattering after all the merit we took at the beginning. But it's very exciting. It has been a hell of a lot of fun. It really has. And if nothing else, I hope at least the students here get an idea of physics is not cold stuff. It is very exciting. And it is very human in what you do and in how you react to it. And I just hope to see this story played out. Okay, thanks a lot. If you give me three of them, I'll do that. The reason being is that I want to test what was seen. In other words, if there is an anomaly, we know it's in the plane of the ecliptic. Okay? What happens if you go out of the plane of the ecliptic and you don't see it? Well, due to the fact that the ecliptic has dust or something? Okay? I want it to duplicate as well as possible to measure better the conditions of the missions which did find it. I want it to be a test. not an exploration. I mean, that's me. Okay. But you give me three, since you give me. Okay.
You talked about the Doppler data. I'm wondering whether the actual time delay data is precise enough by now, after,
you
know, over 30 years.
Well, okay. Let me give an answer in two parts. First, there's a question: is the code that does the Doppler data correct or good? We tested the code with the Galileo ship when it was in cruise, okay? Because at that point it went into spin stabilization, and there they had range, okay, which is time of flight. You put a phase on top of the signal and you put your stopwatch and you wait for it to come back, and yep, there we are. And the range data is consistent with the Doppler data as we use it. So we know it works. Okay? What you lack is basically a phase change. You can do something what you call ranging, where your on and off signals can that's not very precise. And that has been checked and it's consistent as far as we can tell. Okay? But range is what we really want. Since we're on that, you tricked me on another story about bureaucrats. Why did not the pioneers have range? Because there was an administrator who said, that's one more thing that can go wrong. We don't want it to go wrong. Don't do it. That same administrator has risen to very high places in NASA. And he recently was quoted as saying, it's too bad the pioneers didn't have range. This craft would have range. Yeah?
What do you expect to happen to the funding prospects for the next exploration anomaly if 2 years' time you have a lot of
problems? Well, excuse me, I didn't hear the whole question. What do you expect about the funding of the anomaly? Oh, I see. Got it. I'm sorry. Okay. I have a reasonable expectation that we will be sort of like officially, unofficially invited to make a serious white paper proposal. Okay? Now, the timeline for this is quite a ways in the future. In the meantime, we will have looked at the early data. Okay? If the early data comes along and says, hey, this thing is serious, then I expect much more likely something will happen. So I think it's justifiably based on that. What I care about is that we're on the track right now. Okay, so talk to me in a year or two and I'll tell you what I think the chances are. Yes?
One of your folks showed the anomaly map is animals.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You have this Doppler data. Okay? And there's ambiguity as to what direction, since the antenna is not very precise, there's ambiguity as to in what direction in the sky you really are, and therefore what is the exact orbital plane that Pioneer is on, especially after it starts goes by the planets and has basically an orbit which is an ellipse based around a certain planet as it goes along. And these are calculations which are done to 12 to 14 significant figures. Okay? So therefore, at that point, that ambiguity feeds into your orientation of the orbit of your spacecraft compared to the orbits of the planets in the ephemerides. And we think we've got that wrong. Or rather, it's wrong. Okay? And by looking at the earlier data and just doing the whole set, we might be able to determine that. So that's our best guess.
Is there a favorite?
let's say, being an iconoclast, I like, it's very interesting. And that's probably from where I come from. I'm a particle theorist, remember? That means I'm a quantum mechanic. And we all know that quantum mechanics and gravity are not consistent. Okay? So therefore, that means logically, either quantum mechanics or gravity, or both, have to change. Okay? Well, I'm a quantum mechanic. Obviously, the other guy's got to change. So therefore, those theories, which consistent with the experiment, modify gravity, are of interest to me. Don't know if that's a politic enough answer, but that's an answer. Yeah? That is not a viable assumption, simply because if you believe normal gravity and the results of the other experiments which have been done, okay? The reason for that is the orbits of the planets dictate against it. In other words, this effect is not seen in the orbits of the inner planets, and it would be seen there. Okay, so and that combined with the real Ed Bosch experiments sort of rule that out. So people look at that at the beginning, but then they decided, no, that can't be it.
You say this effect wouldn't be seen on the planets, but I assume you're saying you had a disacceleration.
Yeah. That is correct. I mean, like, that's why drag is one of the options which is open. If you've got, dark matter drag, okay? There's one idea out by Foote and Bulkus from Melbourne that you have mirror matter out there, okay? And you could have enough mirror matter to cause this effect by a drag and not have so much matter that gravitationally you would perturb the planets. Basically, matter antimatter is basically a CPT transformation. Mirror matter is matter where you play the same trick only with P symmetry alone. Okay, and then there's a slight breaking which couples slightly so that you don't screw up electrodynamics. But yet there's a big enough charge in this stuff so that when the spacecraft hits it, it won't go all the way through. Okay, you can do it. I mean, you could play that game. So the answer to your question is yes.
Any more questions?
Okay, thanks.